author of the week with Alex Lefchuk and, of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose. Wow, a lot of alliteration from an anxious announcer placed in a powerful post.
Well, what can you say when you started off your life as an underwater photographer and you then decide to actually march your way through Washington State and do all sorts of other things and then set up a shop in the joys of Florida, etc.? Obviously, you're going to be an ace author. And we're delighted to welcome that fantastic author, Stephanie Levine, to the program. How are you, Stephanie?
I'm doing amazing today. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, it's always a delight to feature writers who are kind of engaged with the process and so on, and particularly the creator of the Fox Hill Southern Mystery Series. I know we're not necessarily going to be focusing on that today, but I mean, just the whole line of can a small town get a second chance is just wondrous in its own way. You could almost be writing that about Lincoln. Amazing. It deserves a second chance. However, we've moved on from that to the Sunshine State, Cozy and Crime, Headlines, Deadlines, and Lies. The really exciting line here. Piper Harrington's life is a blur between raising two kids alone and scrambling to keep up at work. She craves a chance to prove her own dreams are valid. When she's given her lucky break to vie for a feature column at the local paper, she jumps at it, even though it requires telling one teensy tiny lie. I can't believe, Stephanie, this is autobiographical, or is it? Were there any sort of moments in your own career where you just thought, maybe I'll just be a little bit economical with the truth?
I think that I have run into a lot of fake it till you make it moments, especially in the very, very beginning, like when I first entered the film industry and had no idea what that meant. You know, graduated with a quote unquote film concentration and showed up in New York and knew absolutely nothing, it turned out, about the business. I could edit a video, I could dissect and analyze an avant-garde film, but working in the film industry was a completely different thing. And yeah, I remember just showing up the first day that I finagled my way into a job and they said, okay, you're on walkies, which was walkie-talkies. And I was like, sure, great, yep, gonna go do that.
Where's the dog?
I have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah. I'm like, but I'm gonna put a huge smile on and walk over with confidence and figure it out. You know, many years later, I knew what walkie-talkies were.
Absolutely.
And how to distribute them.
Years in the New York City or the NYC film industry, professional photographers say specializing in underwater portraits. Of all of the areas that you could probably work within, why underwater portraits? Was it a case of, I'm going to test this camera under all conditions?
Yeah, I think it was a weird combination of, I was always a water person. Like I was a swimmer, a swim instructor, a water polo player. Like I was always in the water. So that was a very comfortable place for me. And ironically, since I'm talking to you, there was one photographer in the world that I heard of that was doing underwater portraits, and she was from the UK. Her and her husband had this business. And I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. That for me, because I'd come from sort of advertising and things like that. And when I decided, oh, I'll do photography, I'm like, but what will I do in photography? I was used to doing ads and things like that. And oh, you can do it underwater. Perfect. And I had already been hired. I'd made a video for an underwater, the United States underwater hockey team, which is very random. And so I had just done that, and because I had video background. And so it just sort of all converged into this random idea of, oh, this makes perfect sense.
Stephanie, as we speak now, they've just had the official opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. I cannot understand for the life of me why underwater hockey is not a recognized sport. For me, the whole 2 weeks has just lost everything now. I'm just not interested. I can't be bothered. Where are those wonderful sort of sporting giants of underwater hockey when you need them? Really, it's just too much.
Right.
But I'll try and get around it. Let's turn to Gabriella Vangenians. Gabriella, of course, an undergraduate in her third year, approaching her third year of journalism at the University of Lincoln. Gabriella, any questions you'd like to put to Stephanie about life, the universe, or indeed her latest awesome text?
Hi, Stephanie. It's nice to meet you. So I'm a big fan of murder mystery books. Like, I'm a big fan of it. And so I'm definitely going to get your new book because it looks great. I was wondering, kind of, how did you come up with the idea for this mystery? Like, did it just come to you or did you like plan it out?
Well, with mysteries, I feel like you always have to plan them a lot more than some other style of books. This one was a bit of a crossover, the Headlines and Lies and Lies, in that I was writing it for a specific audience and for a specific channel, which is, so it's a little bit, like, got a little sweet romance. It's got a small town, and I wanted something that was a little, I wanted to try and see if I could write a mystery that started with less of a cataclysmic event or like a gruesome murder. And so this one has more of a roundabout way. It's a bit more of a subtle mystery in that it's not like, oh no, I've woken up and stumbled upon a dead body. And though I'm not saying that the ones I'm working on now do not have that, but this book in particular was more of finding, I guess, peeling the onion, or there must be some other nicer way to say that, but you know, the sort of mysteries that are in your own family life that you may not notice. And when you start being like, wait a second, why doesn't that add up? Why is there a missing branch of that family tree? And then you're like, oh, there's intrigue and mystery there. So this had a bit of a challenge that I set out specifically to achieve. And then some of them, like the ones I'm working on right now, sometimes I end up with a character or scenario, and then I'm like, oh gosh, like what hijinks will they get into? And so it's slightly variations of a theme, I guess.
A genealogical mystery set in a charming beach town along Florida's Gulf Coast. Is this hyper autobiographical? Is it a case of, well, I'm in Florida, I'm obviously going to write about that? Or were you ever tempted to actually say, oh, you know what, I'll set it in Nebraska?
Well, a lot of my other books that are under pen names are all over, are not in Florida really at all. Actually, I'd say, gosh, I don't think any of my pen names, and I have somewhere, you know, around 40, 50 books in other genres, you know, Colorado or a little North Carolina and New York City, just all over. But when I moved back to Florida, which actually I've been back for quite a while, but when I knew I wanted to start writing mysteries, which I had always intended to write, I suddenly became very fascinated by where I'm from, because I was born here and of course moved away and said it was the worst place on earth. And then many years later, I was like, oh, you kind of come to love the quirks of where you're from sometimes. And even though I'm from what I would call a small city, I'm in Fort Lauderdale, and so we're between Miami and West Palm, and it's a bit beachy. In the Tri-County, you can go to small places and big cities, and we have kind of a good mix, but it's so bizarre here. It is just a very special place in the world where very interesting, crazy, like absurd things happen and people live. And there's something like, I love the weather. I love the palm trees. We have a somewhat of a drought of nature if you want to go hiking. Like, there's a lot of things we don't have, you know, but you know, if you can embrace sort of the good parts, I became really, really intrigued and fascinated and sort of loving the thing that I am from, the place that I'm from, the thing that I probably am.
We have a regular Florida correspondent with the inspirational writer Mike Dooley. And from Mike's piece earlier in the week, it seems you don't have masks either these days. So no masks either in Florida. So it's all good, marvelous.
I just barely leave my house, so I'm like, I never know what's happening. I walk out, I'm like, what's going on now, guys?
That's probably the best way, Stephanie. Now, chocolate chip cookies and beach volleyball. To the uninitiated, that might be seen as an interesting juxtaposition of Stephanie's favorite things. Why are they actually sort of together? Chocolate chip cookies and beach volleyball, though presumably not both at the same time.
Well, you can get one. You either have the cookie before or after or both, if you're doing it right. You know, if you have the cookie before, then you can burn it off during the, you've been fueled. And I'm obsessed with trying to create healthy versions of very decadent desserts just so that I can have an excuse to eat them as much as I want. So I'm always like, no, there's really good ingredients in this. It's a cookie, but it's breakfast. And that doesn't go over all the time, with everyone, particularly my family. We're like, no, you're just eating cookies. But yeah, I don't know. I really like chocolate chip cookies, it turns out. But like anywhere I go, I've always had to try them. You know, you realize that you have a thing that you're into. Once you realize when you're traveling, you're always like, oh, I must try that thing. And they're like, oh, is this a thing? Is this a thing that's me? Is this my own issue or my own personality flaw or quirk or whatever it is? But so yeah, it turns out I really love that. And volleyball is just really fun. I wish I had played in high school instead of doing all the other things I did. And then I would be a professional volleyball player talking to you right now and not an author.
Yeah, it's not the same as being an underwater photographer, especially when you've actually got underwater hockey. It's very, very important. Gabriella, anything else you'd like to add into the mix at present? Chocolate chip cookies, for instance.
Oh, I love chocolate chip cookies. I love, you know, like Ben and Jerry's, like you get like chocolate chip, like cookie dough and stuff. That's like, I could literally eat that forever. But I was just going to ask you, Stephanie, how did you actually get into writing? Because you said earlier you were doing film and then obviously underwater photography. So how did you go from underwater photography to being an author?
I had this very... I don't know if it's a strange journey, but basically I was always doing some version of writing. I think people who are writers are always writery, you know, you always write in some capacity. And so it was always a part of my life. And I didn't ever know how it would translate into a profession necessarily. Even though I was a big reader, I did not necessarily know I would become a fiction author. I read a lot of fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction and own a lot of reference books, but I was just always writing and, you know, maybe it would be in film, maybe it would be in theater, which I was involved in. But when I got into film, I thought I would go in a bit of a different direction. I thought I would be more on the creative end, but because I went in sort of blind and just started running at full speed to have a career and, you know, pay my bills and support myself right away. And it was fun and wonderful people, but it was really not having any idea what the quote unquote, you know, the film industry in and of itself was and how it worked. And so you're just sort of saying, yes, okay, I can do that. Sure, I'm showing up tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. and I will work. And so at some point I stopped after a couple of years and said, I think I need to reassess. And because I knew I wanted to be on the creative end. And how do you do that when you're in a huge center or huge city like New York? And I thought, okay, I want to be a writer. And so I sat down and wrote a book. And then at the end, I think it was 1 to 3 months, it was like a holiday. And I was back home and just relaxing and soul searching. And I said, I want to be a writer. I wrote a book. And then I decided to become an underwater photographer. So then that went on to launch the next several years. And it was almost like the way I think of it was I knew what I wanted to do, but in some capacity, I think I was scared to fail at the thing that I cared most about. And succeeding at something that I was good at. I was good at photography and it was somewhat easy for me to do and to transition into because they're all writing and film and photography and video. They're all self-similar in a way. And so I just, you know, I built a whole business and company and career doing this thing, but I always deep down knew it wasn't the right thing. And eventually I just had to stop and say again, okay, if every time I start from scratch and build a career and build a life around these things that I don't love 100% and always deep down, you know it, you're always feeling like, ah, when am I going to do this other thing? Or this is more stressful than it is fun at this point. Cause jobs are always stressful. You know, I get stressed being a writer, but it's a different stress now. I'm not looking to escape now. The way I used to be like, oh, what is next? What's the other thing? And so eventually I just had to say, just start. You have to just start now. And I just started secretly doing it, which kind of, I think, built the confidence to eventually do it out loud and do it and say, look, I've been doing this for a couple of years secretly, but we tend to be our own worst enemies. We tend to be our own worst critics. And I think keep ourselves down, keep yourself small, especially if it's something that you really care about, which is bizarre and weird in its own way, but it's just a human, you know, some sort of human condition to keep us safe and to try and keep our little fragile human egos like, okay. And, you know, and then you start, but it's so weird because at the same time you can, you know, raise you know, to the top of some profession or anything. You could become known for something else because you don't, your ego isn't invested in, or your heart isn't invested in the same way. And you're like, oh, why was I not scared to do this? And I'm scared to do this. And so, yes. And eventually now I am here and now I'm, I still
These
have my moments.
Valid sage words of advice. I'm sure Gabriella, as an undergraduate present, will be taking this on board. And I fully anticipate an awful lot more entrance into underwater photography as a result of journalism degrees at the University of Lincoln. But there we are. Let's move on, Stephanie, because, I mean, just looking at this biography here, it's cinematic in its own way, because we have, and I quote, from hopping trains across the United States to crewing a sailboat on a transatlantic crossing, from mushing dogs on a Canadian dog sled to unwittingly hiking Mount Washington. Okay, now any one of those for most people would probably be, well, you know, I've hiked Mount Washington, that's fine. I've done mush mush with the dog in the background with the Alaskan sort of dog sled, or Canadian dog sled, I should say. Or I've crewed a sailboat on a transatlantic crossing. And let's not forget the hopping trains across the United States. Was this just a case of you just wanted to leave Florida? Was that a key thing? Or was it just a case of, let me out of here, I've got to go with this?
This is actually a long line of, I was on the sailboat when I was fairly young, and I was lucky enough to have that experience. And so, and then at a different, they're all at different junctures of my life, I'd say, actually. You know, there was large spans of time, and I had a lot of adventures in between there that don't make it into the bio. But I think part of that is being someone who's just very interested in having experiences, just experiential living in general. I've always wanted to see firsthand everything, I see how live with different people, meet different people, different ways of life, and experience things for myself. And so anytime some of those opportunities come up, some of those opportunities I've made, a lot of those. And, you know, a lot of times it's just also saying yes to the moment and whatever comes of it. And that maybe I'm the kind of person who attracts those things as well, because I'm like, oh.
It's just extraordinary because it goes on. Like that, whether sleeping on sailboats, in front yards, in yurts, tents, castles, squats, luxury hotels, flea bag motels, on couches, under fold-out tables, on film sets, in hammocks, or on freight trains, you'll find her laughing loudly and proclaiming that, if nothing else, her life has never been dull. Now, there's a lot of sort of sleeping areas there, Stephanie. Is this something that you could say, where have I not slept? I mean, have you ever slept underwater with, you know, whilst doing photography, etc.? Is this a case of, if he can sleep somewhere, that's where you're going?
I do have an unusual, abnormal obsession with places to stay. Like, I've been fairly obsessed with unique hotels and now Airbnbs and lodging for as long as I can remember, whether it was like tree houses or houseboats or yurts. I love me a yurt, you know, camping. Certain hotels I would just see and be like, I need to stay there. I don't know what it is, but when I was a photographer, I was also a architectural photographer, which focuses on, mostly I worked with interior designers and photographed really beautiful interiors. I love houses. I love lodging. So that was a really, really fun thing for me to do and a really nice fit, but it goes back for a really long time. I have no idea, but I love hotels and earth houses, just anything sustain. I've always wanted to build my own sort of eco-sustainable house with off the grid. I have not gotten there yet, but yeah, something about that. I think that's why it made it into the bio, and I probably should take it out one day because it's such a specific thing. But yes, but I don't know. Like, for me, that's exciting when I'm planning a trip. I'm like, where are we going to stay? Where am I going to? That's a huge part of it. I have no idea why.
How does your family react to this? I mean, do the children sort of say, that's mom, she's just going for it? Is your husband sort of an encourager? Because I can understand there's a slight tension in the air, really. You say, look, I don't care, let's just go with it.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, since this has happened for a long time, a lot of my good adventures have happened prior to children and husbands, but they have The kids are very excited. I took two of them. I have three. The other day to stay in an RV in Miami, like in South Miami, I was like, surprise. And it was just because they are really into the idea of RVs right now, which I probably planted that. But that's okay. And so we just went, and then we went exploring. We went to some of the national parks, that the little ones that you don't really go to, and just made an adventure out of it. So they definitely have that from me, because they're always asking to do things. I have this sort of epic North American trip planned in my head, and it's completely based on, you know, okay, there's a treehouse here, and then there's this yurt here, and then there's this fantastic hotel. Like, in Canada has these hotel chain that I really love, because I went as a teenager. And so they're always like, when are we going? And my husband's like, can you sell more books? So he'd be up for it as long as he can quit his job and completely just enjoy it. So as soon as he's able to do that, then everyone will be on board.
Well, although this is radio and the scenery is so much better, you may have gathered we've been talking about a range of other things, including the beachfront and Miami and so on. But currently up there, we have Diamonds and Dirt, Music, Money and Mayhem, book one in the Fox Hill Southern Mystery Tour. Just talk us through, I mean, I know that sometimes authors have a big say in the design of the book, the artistic sort of elements that come through within that. But I'm just thinking, I mean, I'm getting connotations there of the kind of classic road trip there with the truck on the road and so on. Was that something you had in mind, or was it just a case of, you know, that looking up at the stars and the constellations, etc.? It was just what happened to sort of fit the actual text at the time.
With that series, I really struggled with the covers. And this is actually what you're looking at is a redo. And I designed all the covers, because every time I try to hire a cover designer, I end up having to switch things around, and it's way less streamlined than I want it to be. But if you're a fabulous cover designer, please get in touch with me so I can stop doing them. But yeah, there is a red truck, a red old pickup truck. The main character comes back to the town and gets picked up by her childhood best friend in the, you know, the old truck that they used to cruise around with in as kids. That was, you know, I wanted something that fit my aesthetic, my sort of overall aesthetic with my Florida books, which is where I'm going to be publishing a lot more in now, but that still had that sort of cozy but bright and ethereal feeling. And I don't know, this one, it probably doesn't translate 100% into mystery the way it should, and I know that about covers, but it still made me happy.
First time I saw it, I thought, alien abduction, but I was completely off base there. You know, it's a different line entirely. Yeah. Maybe it's just too much time in Florida. And of course, I mean, you've got your Disney World, you've got your Orlando resorts, you've got your Universal tour, etc. Clearly, they just need to sign you up, Stephanie, to just actually go through a whole range of other factors. Have you left the state? I mean, apart from the transatlantic journey, have there been any sort of times when you've headed over to, I don't know, Europe, Australia, Antarctic, any of those zones?
I have been to the Caribbean a lot. I've been to Central America, mostly Costa Rica. I've spent a lot of time in Canada, and I have been to the airport in Iceland, which I am very excited to go back to beyond the airport one day. And I was in Iceland on my way to Europe, and I did a really fun, so I've been to Europe twice, first the transatlantic, and that was more the south of Spain and a little bit Portugal and Azores. But when I went later, when I was living in New York, I flew over because I had a boyfriend at the time whose family had just moved to Germany. He's a wonderful person. He still is wonderful, and not my boyfriend, but good friend. And he had gone over there from New York, where we were both living. And so I went to visit him, and then my best friend flew over, and we did a epic European road trip, she and I, just all around Europe, which was amazing and super fun. And so, but I still haven't been to the UK, and she's married to a Scottish Brit. Chris Monk is my brother-in-law, and he's born in Scotland, raised in the UK, so he claims both, but I have to say both.
I must check out with Reykjavik to see whether there is indeed at Reykjavik Airport a Stephanie Levine once passed through here plaque.
Yeah.
it should obviously be there.
Most definitely is there. No.
Yeah, let's turn back to Gabriella again. I mean, you've been listening to what we've been chatting about and so on, Gabriella. Any other things you'd like to raise?
Oh, Stephanie, it just sounds like you always have like such a great adventures and all on your trips and stuff. And you must come to the UK, must come to Lincoln and try. We have really good fish and chips up in Lincoln, so definitely come and try some. What would you say is like the best trip that you've been on, like that just really sticks in your mind?
You know, sometimes I'm asked that and I, one, never have favorites. I'm just a terrible person for favorites. Like I've kind of narrowed down the chocolate chip thing as to a go-to, but I'm still like, is it my favorite? So trips are so completely impossible because they all have such different memories, you know, and they, when you're on a freight train, it's like, well, there's not a lot of glamour to that, but it's such a unique experience. And both hot and cold and rickety and alienating. And you go through a lot of emotions being in a very, very small space or, you know, traveling around Europe with my best friend when you don't know how to drive a stick shift. And you know, we figured it out, but that is definitely a clunky few days. And so I don't know, they're all so special. I think, you know, all the things that we do, I think they add so much to our lives. Like the little trips, like sometimes I just did one a couple of years ago for the same best friend's Hindu, as we called it, because she was marrying a Brit, but her bachelorette party. And it was not the most exotic in running around, but it was so filled with laughter and conversations with people you've known, you know, that your two closest girlfriends. And we rented mini speedboats and did a tree climbing course and went to comedy.
So a fairly quiet party then, basically, fairly mild.
it was in Florida. We drove 4 hours to a different city that we've never really spent a lot of time in. And we just had an amazing time, even though compared to so many other things I've done, I'm like, it was relatively simple. But yeah, I guess it was like a week of all of our favorite things.
And there's a case in point, Stephanie. If you drove 4 hours in one direction in British Isles, you'd probably cover at least nearly two thirds of the country, basically. You'd move from Gabriella's place just outside Ipswich, past Lincoln, you'd be up the Highland, you'd be at Aberdeen, basically. 4 hour drive, it'd be phenomenal. You know, it's great stuff. 50, I'll say that again, 50 novels that you've actually written. I mean, you're too young to have written 50 novels. What is it? Do you have sort of other people who actually ghostwrite for you? Did you dictate them? How many 50 novels? I mean, many people actually say just 4 or 5, but 50.
But differing lengths. So novelettes and whatnot, you know, when we sometimes round because it's hard when you're putting out a lot. In the early days, and I mean, I haven't been at this for all that long, you know, I think I'm coming up on my 5-year anniversary as of this recording. But
10 a year though.
We're trying a lot of different things. Yeah. I think I did a lot in the beginning, you know, you stockpile and then you put out in there and it went from, oh, shorter books to longer books. Like now they're getting much longer. And now I auto dictate a lot more, which is a bit easier well, it's terrible on editing because the auto dictation, we have, you know, I always call Siri because that's on my phone. I'm like, she has no idea what I'm saying. I get back and I'm like, what did I say? What was that even supposed to mean? I can't. Yeah, that's both faster and slower. But, you know, I was really trying to learn the business side when I started. And part of that was having a lot of things to release in a lot of different arenas. And so now it's slowing up quite a bit. I hope to get faster again, but you know, different phases where you focus on different things.
Well, let's move back to Piper Harrington, of course. We talked about her earlier. She's scrambling for a topic to keep readers hooked. She dives into the world of genealogy, something she knows absolutely nothing about. Presumably, she's obviously dealing with stick shift drives as well from that point of view, which could be an interesting line. And as we said, investigation turns up more questions than answers, and her findings threaten to open up a Pandora's box that can't be closed. Headlines, deadlines, and lies. Is this something whereby, in terms of Piper Harrington, we can see a series manifesting? Is it a case of, yeah, we need more PH narratives in the world to make it a better place? Could we actually look forward to a Piper Harrington theme park with genealogy and other areas as well in times to come?
Oh, I'm sure the tickets are starting to sell right away from you just mentioning that. I'm like, ooh, family trees, genealogy, theme park. Yes. Maybe my mom would go to that. This was originally sort of positioned to be able to be turned into a TV series for a certain channel that is very heartwarming and very cozy. After I wrote it, I've kind of gotten inspired to do some other things. So right now I feel like she's really complete where she is in that book. And I think I have been asked by readers to keep going. So once I get these other ones out of my system, because I have some sort of larger series with more female PIs, private investigators, detectives, I think we call it slightly different things. And they really, really, really want to be written. I don't know that I want to write them. I don't know. My characters don't sit there and be like, write me. But I get stuff stuck in my head and I'm like, right now I'm vying between two of them. And I'm like, and they're Florida, they're South Florida. The Piper Harrington, she's in the panhandle of Florida, which is not where I'm from. So it was kind of fun because it's a different region. It's a little bit of a different feel up there. And so now I have to come down and sort of get out of my system, my local world that I've been building for a long time. That it's another part of the Sunshine State. It's just a different subsection of that series. So Cozy and Crime are sort of standalones as of right now, and a bit cozier, a bit more small town. And then another section of the series as a whole is sort of this other little bit more. It's in the city, still a small city, beachside city. I love my beaches.
So. Was very important, and only you could actually say that, Stephanie, with solid lines. I love my beaches. Wonderful stuff. Yeah. If people want to get in touch with your good self, is it a case of the usual socials, or should they go directly to stephanielevigne.com? And it's Levigne, LIVIGNE.com. Where would you point people?
You can go there if you can spell it, and at that I applaud you. And there you could find any of the normal socials. I'm mostly, Amazon, all my books, and Instagram, BookBub, Goodreads, Facebook. I'm terrible at Twitter, so if you tweet me there and I never tweet you back, I apologize profusely. Find me somewhere else and I will apologize.
Stephanie, there was a former president of your country who was also fairly bad at Twitter. He ended up being banned. I don't want to talk about him, but he's still trying to get back on there, but what the heck?
I don't want the same fate.
Yeah.
dreadful Twittering.
There we are. Okay. We're round to two final closing little lines. So, Stephanie Levigne, has it been a reasonably interesting Zoomer for your good self? Has it been okay for yourself? Because obviously in Florida time, actually it's 12, I would have thought it's 12 noon now? Is it coming out to 12 noon in terms of that?
Yeah,
it's not too early. So you're going to have a great afternoon. Has it been okay for you? Have you enjoyed this Zoomer?
This has been fantastic. I was a bit unprepared because I could not find shows to watch before. And so this was beyond surprisingly wonderful and delightful. And it was so nice to show up and see your two faces and talk with you guys. I could not have asked for a better late morning start to my day.
Well, Stephanie, you will be straight into our Author of the Week feature, and there's a whole range of shows you can actually access there. Audio only, but occasionally they're sort of all from that point of view, so there are all there. So can we then, Stephanie, invite you back? Will you come back again in the not-too-distant future to bring us more sunshine fun and, of course, advice on underwater photography, particularly underwater sports, in the near future? Will you come back?
I would love to. I'm going to get right writing as soon as I get off of this, so that I can come back and have Gabriella have a new book to ask me about. But I would come back and talk about anything. We can talk about anything you guys want. You just tell me and I will be here.
I mean, this is just Stephanie Levigne, a Renaissance woman. Take care, and indeed stick shift driver. Take care, be well, and be happy.
Thanks, you guys. Bye.
£133.7 million. I'll say that again. £133.7 million. That's the amount that's been spent on charities between April and June this year, 16% up on the first 3 months of 2021. How do I know this? Well, it's all part of some of the wonderful findings of the latest quarterly spending report by Nationwide. And we're delighted to welcome from the Nationwide Building Society the head of payments there. That's Mark Nolder. How are you, Mark?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Great. Now, I mean, this is obviously a demonstration, if further demonstration was needed, that actually there's an awful lot of goodwill and kindness with respect to people donating to charity, despite the challenges we've been having with respect to pandemics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really refreshing to see that increase in our member spend in charity over the past 3 months. I think it's been really helped by, I guess, the high street reopening and those charity shops reopening. But also, I think there's been that almost that pent up frustration that we haven't been able to spend on charities during the last 12 months. And as the UK restrictions have started to ease, we've been able to do some more charity events, and I guess reflected in the spending that we're seeing.
It's interesting, the breakdown between essential spends, things like utilities, obviously power bills, gas, water, electricity and so on, taxis, of course, transport, public transport, and the non-essential spend. And there has been an increase in terms of the non-essential spend, which is certainly good news for the leisure industries, because it's very much focusing on eating out, holidays, hospitality, drinking, gardening, and of course, leisure and recreation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real increase in that spend in the last quarter. Not quite to where we were probably at the start of last year, kind of pre-pandemic, but definitely we're going that way. But holiday spend, you know, we've seen a real boost in the last 3 months, where, you know, I guess staycations in the UK, where people decided to stay in the UK this year, but also further afield and to get some of that summer sun, maybe in Europe or wider afield, we've definitely seen a real spike in that as well. And I guess the eating out and drinking is probably no real surprise there for hopefully, you know, your viewers have been able, your listeners have been able to enjoy meeting friends and out for a drink or going out for something to eat. And we've seen that reflected in the spend in the last quarter.
Yeah, viewers are fine, Mark. I mean, I'm sure that as well as the traditional radio way of listening, people can be actually looking at their computer whilst they're listening to this as well. So it's all great stuff. You know, it's a theatre of the mind. That's important. From the eye-watering department of these fascinating figures, more than £22 billion were actually spent by Nationwide members during the second quarter of the year. And that's based on 566 million transactions. So in a real sense, obviously, the flow of money through the economy, the financial transactions, does this indicate that actually the economy is, I hesitate to use the phrase bouncing back, but is it a case of this is good, positive stuff for us as a nation?
I think it absolutely is. I think we're all quite nervous to understand how we'd react to, I guess, easing out of lockdown and whether people would, you know, return to restaurants and bars and whether people would return back into their gyms and stuff. But what we've seen in the last quarter is that absolutely happened. You know, people are really looking forward to going out and actually even spending money and which is great. And I think, you know, Is it too early to say we're bouncing back? I think it's a real positive 3 months, and I would expect that trend to continue over the next quarter as well.
Presumably, people's work habits, as the possibility of hybridized patterns of work continues, people working from home, there'll be areas such as obviously home improvements, decor, and again, offsetting that, despite the fact that there's a case of, oh, you've got to go back to the office, maybe in terms of efficiency, there are many of us who are actually finding that actually it's more efficient to work from a home environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we've seen, you know, you talked about, you know, the non-essential spend earlier. We've seen a continued increase in kind of gardening spend and home improvements in again this quarter. And I think that's where people have really, you know, really enjoy being at home, actually, you know, creating more space in their house and in their home, and where that's their garden. And again, it'd be interesting to see, you know, as we come out of lockdown completely, how many people actually go back to the office. You know, at Nationwide, we've given all our employees the option of working at home full time in the future. So, you know, we're really supportive of that model, because I think it's really good for that work life balance. But, you know, we absolutely expect that, you know, some people, you know, will be returning back to the office. And I think we'll see that in the essential spend. So, you know, travel, kind of your TfL, your taxis and your public transport. interesting to see how that increases over the next 3 months or 6 months as we do start return back to some sort of working normality.
Looking at the sort of general categories of spending, I mean, airline travel is obviously up there. We've talked about charities, clothing, dating. We haven't actually mentioned. Well, any surprises for yourself, Mark, in terms of you think, well, I didn't think we'd actually be spending that amount of money on health and beauty. I thought we'd all given up on that with respect to, obviously, the Zoom packages that we're doing.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? But I think, again, you know, a lot of us, you know, not so much the massage and nails for me, but you know, I think there was that, you know, a lot of people hadn't had a haircut for a long time, a lot of people hadn't been to their beauty salons, a lot of people were maybe going out for the first time in 16 months or going to a wedding that had been delayed. So that spend doesn't really surprise me. I think, you know, that will probably go back to kind of a normal kind of rate of increase over the next 6 months. But you know, there's not much in the report that I think we expected this. We expected that the volumes to really increase in most of these areas over this period, because I think, you know, we were really confident as the UK came out, our members would go out and spend their money.
Not sure whether this actually can be identified by the report, or maybe it can actually, but do you feel that we're shifting more and more towards a cashless society, that actually it's the old not just chip and pin, but the contactless payment that seems to be becoming more and more prevalent? I mean, certainly from my own point of view, I think I've had probably 3 cash transactions in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I think, you know, cashless, no. I think, you know, it's definitely a declining payment type. But, you know, a number of our, you know, a proportion of our members still like to use cash, and you know, cash is available for, you know, for all our members to use whenever they need it. I think the challenge will be now, I think, as the UK comes out of lockdown with the high street reopening and retailers reopening, what we're seeing is, you know, retailers aren't accepting cash anymore. You know, a lot of them aren't accepting cash anymore. No, it's card only, or card as a preferred method. So I do think there's probably 2 angles to this. One, you know, consumers are much happier now using their card or their mobile phone. You know, we've seen a massive increase in mobile payments in the last 6 months. You know, people are really comfortable with security on their phone now. And, you know, when you leave your house now, 10 years ago, I think you'd have taken out your wallet whereas now you take out your mobile phone. And people are really comfortable spending on their mobile phone, and it's just quick and convenient. But I do think, you know, retailers, you know, there's not as many retailers, you know, accepting cash as kind of primary method anymore, and that's probably a challenge to some of our consumers. But you know, card definitely is very simple, very secure for our members, and you know, so we're definitely seeing that increase set to continue.
Yeah, I think I stick with the card, actually. I'm not quite moving into the mobile phone thing as yet. It's just an old-fashioned thing. Although, having said that, I have had the experience, not, I hasten to add, with Nationwide, whereby the card has actually been refused, not because there was insufficient funds, but because I've been locked out of the pass key that was actually there. But that's another line entirely. It's a frustration still. So life continues. It's the old technology. Do you have any predictions, Mark, that you'd like to suggest that's going to happen over the next quarter or so? I mean, do you think that maybe pet spending could continue to increase and improve? Or is it a case of, no, with fuel going up at the cost it is and inflation going up, we'll all be spending our money on fuel?
We're definitely seeing an increase in fuel. I think we've seen that in the last quarter as well. You know, not to the levels, I still don't think to the levels we saw before, because I think, like you said earlier, you know, we're not seeing as many people do as much travel before into the office and stuff. You know, from a personal point of view, my fuel bill is down by probably 2/3 even now, and I'm traveling a bit into the office, but I'm definitely not doing as much travel as I was 12 months ago, and I think I've really enjoyed that. Pet spend's interesting. That, you know, a lot of us bought pets, or, you know, got pets in the last 12, 18 months for, you know, kind of, you know, to have a companion, to be able to kind of spend time at home with them and stuff. And so pet spend will continue, because obviously, you know, pets need looking after. So we're seeing a real increase in kind of pet spend. In terms of predictions, I think, you know, the increase in volume and spend is set to continue. I'm really confident on that. I think what we'll see, you know, we've touched on mobile payments and contactless payments. We'll see a real surge again in contactless payments over the next 6-12 months. You know, contactless limits increasing to £100 in October this year, and that'll be available for all our members from October. So that again would drive more contactless transactions. And we've seen a real push in the last kind of 12-18 months towards online transactions as well. So people are, you know, purchasing kind of, you know, clothes and stuff they would have historically gone to a high street for. We're seeing more and more shift towards kind of online kind of shopping in this period. So that's set to continue as well.
Changing times indeed. Nationwide.co.uk presumably will be the recommended place to go to, Mark, if you're looking to find out further details and drill down into the data even further.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great place for our members to go to get any tips on what payment types are best for them and any security tips they may need to make sure that their payments are safe and secure.
Mark Nalder, Head of Payments at Nationwide Building Society. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and continue your fine work.
Thank you very much.
Britain is an island, fairly self-evident phrase, but it's also got lots of nooks and crannies and areas that may well be difficult to locate, especially if you're trying to actually get there in a hurry. And to talk about ways forward with respect to this, we're delighted to welcome HM Coast Guard's Strategic Maritime Commander, the fabulous Matt Leet, to the programme today. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, morning, Alex. I'm really well, and thanks for having us.
Absolute delight. Now, in terms of the way in which finding out and mapping, I mean, you might have been one of these people that thinks, surely we've mapped every single millimetre of the country now. We can easily locate where Crazy Mary's Hole is or Nuncle Dink's or any of the other nicknames for things with respect to that. But this can cause problems, certainly if people do get into difficulties around the coast, can't it, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Ordnance Survey have done an absolutely amazing job over the years of mapping out every inch of the UK, Yeah, and they've done that brilliantly. But, you know, lots of people in local communities will call things various names. And as generations change, you know, they will refer to things differently. And, you know, Ordnance Survey just haven't been able to know that information. You know, it's not the official name for a place. You know, we've worked with Ordnance Survey to produce the FinTAM product. And what that enables us to do is to take local place names that a community may name something and actually put that into the Ordnance Survey mapping system so that, you know, when somebody's at the coast and they find themselves in difficulty, they straight away phone 909 and ask for the Coast Guard. When they talk to us and tell us, you know, I'm at Merkin's Pullover, or, you know, I'm at Cocklepole or Tide and Time Bell Sculpture, we know where they are. And what that does is that reduces the time it takes for us to actually, you know, deploy one of our amazing Coast Guard rescue teams, you know, that some of the brilliant lifeboat crews that we've got around the UK, or our Coast Guard rescue helicopters. So it's all about saving time. And the more time that we can save, the more chance we've got to help people, you know, and avert a tragedy.
Does FinTAN actually stand as an acronym for anything? Is it just a case of, no, we just thought it sounded good, so we called it FinTAN?
That's a really good question that I don't know the answer to, actually.
I suppose it could be fantastic initiative, normalizing, something like that, on that sort of basis. But anyway, it could be another little thought. The key thing, of course, is most folk might have actually thought, well, you know, surely we don't have that many incidents around the coast. We do, of course. I mean, look at last year, 33,000 incidents were reported around the coast. So clearly from your day-to-day work, it's fairly critical, as you've already said, that people can actually respond quickly and the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency are able to get to people who are in difficulties as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. We had our busiest summer ever, you know, on record last year, you know, and this summer it's looking to be a busy one too, with people, you know, not having to go or not being able to go abroad, and people on staycations. Lots of people are going to go and visit the coast, and why wouldn't they? It's a brilliant place to go. You know, we've all had lots of fun at the, you know, down the beach, and that's what it's about. It's about having fun and doing that in a safe way. So any tools that we can have to help us, you know, if somebody gets into trouble, you know, we hugely welcome. But a lot of it's about, you know, in an ideal world, not getting into trouble. So people can take some simple steps when they visit the coast. So first of all, visit a beach with lifeguards. You know, that's the first step. Take a fully charged mobile phone with you. So if you do need to call for the Coast Guard, you know, you can do that straight away. Stay away from cliff edges and cliff tops, and don't go and climb cliffs. You know, they're not necessarily stable structures. So stay away from those. And don't take inflatable toys to the beach either. You know, they're designed for swimming pools, not to be taken out to sea. So people can do some people can do some basic things to keep themselves safe. And then the final thing is, if you find yourself in the water, you know, the water around the UK at the moment is still really cold. But if you do find yourself in the water and you're in difficulty, don't fight against it. You know, there'll be a thing called cold water shock, where you may sort of thrash around and try and breathe really heavily. Don't do that. Lay on your back, spread your arms and legs like a starfish, and float to live. And effectively, wait for that body's reaction to pass. And at that point, once you've kind of regained control of your breathing, you know, and you're in a good place, you can then shout for help. You can then try and swim to a place of safety. So it's about, you know, taking, you know, that little bit of kind of time to prepare to hopefully never have to call 999. But if you do call 999 and you're using a local place name, then there's a really good chance that we'll know where that is and we can get, you know, someone out to help you really quickly.
Yeah, really good that you're focusing on prevention being better than cure. And certainly that Float to Live campaign, which we covered earlier in the year, is absolutely critical. Are there any sort of differences geographically in terms of where people are more likely to get into trouble? I mean, you know, if they go off to Skegness, is that more problematic and dangerous than heading up the East Coast to, I don't know, Saltburn, or indeed round to the southwest of the land? Or is it just a case of, at the end of the day, human beings can get into trouble wherever they happen to be?
Yeah, I think people can get into difficulty wherever they go, you know, and we do see busier areas. And some of the time it's just because, you know, they are places where people tend to congregate, you know. So there's some great places there that you mentioned where, you know, we do have a lot of incidents because the population is much greater. But again, if people, you know, just prepare before they go, check tide times. You know, a lot of people, you know, on a Sunday afternoon will go for a coastal walk, but they don't check the tide time. So they might get cut off by the tide. So it's just really about, you know, taking that little bit of preparation, knowing what to do if you do get into trouble. And, you know, if you do get into trouble, you know, we will be there to help. But it's make that 999 call really quickly. Let us know as soon as you can. And then also before you go out, if you're going to go out on a coastal walk and you maybe don't know the area too well, just work out your route and know some of the place names where you are, because, you know, if you know that you've left, you know, Skegness, and, you know, you've gone north up towards Mablethorpe or wherever it may be, you know, and you're in a little village or a town or whatever it is, you know, if you can say that name to us, it will mean that we can find you much quicker. We'll use the Ordnance Survey mapping to help us locate where you are, looking at some of the features on the land, you know, then maybe some buildings or a pier or a jetty, whatever it may be. But if you have that, you know, information ahead of time, it just smooths the process, makes it much quicker.
And if people actually want to find out further details about the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency, the MCA, or indeed FinTAM, this delightful Ordnance Survey device that actually assists, where would you suggest they should actually go, Matt?
So from a FinTAM perspective, really FinTAM is designed to actually work in our control rooms, you know, in our Maritime Rescue Coordination Centres. So really, you could visit the Ordnance Survey website. There's information on there that you can find out. And for you know, information on HM Coast Guard, we've got presence on all of the social media platforms, as well as the MCA's own website on Gov.UK, where you can find lots of good safety information about how to keep safe at the coast this summer.
And are there signs, Matt, that people aren't paying attention? I mean, thankfully, we don't see too much these days about things like tombstoning, which I always thought was an insane activity that was sometimes engaged in by young people in the southwestern parts, diving into the ocean, all sorts of things. I mean, is sense prevailing, or do you still sort of sometimes just look heavenwards and think, what are we seeing here?
You know, I think people are much, you know, there is a greater awareness now of water safety, which is great. However, you know, that there's always, you know, people who don't understand the risks and, you know, do things that others may perceive as silly. But ultimately, you know, they're putting their own life at risk. So as you say, tombstoning, we do still see it, you know, and you know, a lot of younger people will go to the coast and think it's a great idea to do. They're jumping into the unknown. They don't know what's below the surface. You know, there could be all sorts there. So people are much more aware.
Go to Acapulco, dive off the sort of Brazilian coast. That's a different line entirely, but still, that's even though I'd still say it's not right. It's not right. You shouldn't do it, but there we are. Matt, it's been fantastic having some thoughts with your good self today. Keep up the excellent work that you're actually doing and saving lives, obviously, and doing some fantastic work as well with Her Majesty's Coast Guard as Strategic Maritime Commander. We salute you, sir. Take care.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.